So happy Sunday, everybody. What a great day, right? In fact, I am almost sorry to do this to you, but it's Sunday, and we're going to talk about the Mondays. And I'm sorry, like, I know, we come to church to rest, to get a refreshing sort of time out and a pause. And we try in worship service to get some needed perspective and transcendence. And Sunday is supposed to kind of be one way of escaping the madness and chaos of the workday. But, there's nothing I can do to stop the fact that Monday's coming. And being a Christian means that, in a sense, every workday is also the Lord's day. So we need to figure this out. And what's kind of amazing, and what we've been talking about for a little bit, is that the Bible talks an awful lot about work, and I'm really excited about the chance to talk about this topic, because I'm convinced that if we could start connecting worship to work, Sundays to Monday through Friday, I think it would make, it would change your work week. It would make your work more purposeful, I think. And I think it would start to make our worship more relevant and meaningful if we could connect worship to work. Now, if you're here last week, we learned something a little bit surprising and maybe controversial, that people, if you read the creation story, we were not designed to escape from work. We were made in the image of God. God in the Bible is a worker. He is a creator. And when we're made in His image, part of that means that you and I were designed to work, to maintain, to create all the things that God's given us, which means that work isn't an inconvenience. Work isn't something that gets in the way of living or what you're supposed to be doing. In creation, work is exactly what you are made to do. And here's where we left off in the story of human history. We were in Genesis 2:15 is where we left off. And we read, this seems a little crazy, the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden. Why? To work it and keep it. You see that? Like, that's what people were made for. Like, God makes the heavens and the earth, and He makes people, and He blesses them. You can read the story. Puts them in a Garden of Eden in paradise. And do you know what people did in paradise? They worked. Which, I was like, what? Like, when I think about paradise, I think it should be like going on a cruise. And I've never been on a cruise, but I imagine that when you go on a cruise, you find lots of people at work, but they're all working for you, right? You go to check in, and you find where you're going, and there's entertainment, and people say, let us know if you need anything. Like, when you're in paradise, you don't work, other people work for you. That sounds great to me. But when God puts Adam and Eve in a Garden of Eden, they're there, you see, to work, which should tell us a little something about how you and I were created, how we're wired, what we're designed to do. And last week, if you were here, what we looked at it from the Bible is the fact that there's something that you might not know about people, and that's that God made us. Or I'll put it this way, you are most closely aligned with your created design. You are living on purpose when you're living like God, who is a worker. And we talked about this last week, and you know, it sounds great, right? The blessing of work, and we could talk about it from the Bible. We could talk about that for a while. It is an easy sell to talk about how wonderful work is, unless you've tried it, right? Because you may have tried working, and it doesn't always feel like paradise. And by the way, I'll say this, work isn't just a career or a paying job. Work is creating breakfast for kids who aren't hungry. That's work. Work is driving in traffic. Work is trying to get along with people on a team or in a family. Work is fixing stuff on your long list of to-dos, things that are broke. Work is volunteering for worthwhile causes. Work is getting out of bed in the morning. It's working with frustrating customers, technology, animal. Work is having to call your insurance company. I mean, that's pretty awful. Or having to work through a pile of laundry. Like, all of you work. Like, and look, it might be what God makes you for, but let's be honest today, it doesn't usually feel like a blessing. A lot of times it feels terrible. Like, sometimes it almost feels like you're trying to work, and it's like it's cursed. Like, whatever you do, wherever you turn, everything that could go wrong goes wrong. Have you asked why? You ever asked why work can be such a pain? Now, the Bible answers it in a fascinating way. And I think that if we listen to how the Bible answers this question of why work is so hard, I think it will help you succeed even when things are really hard. So last week, if you're here, we looked at Genesis chapter 1 and 2, and we saw this beautiful picture of work. God made people, and when we left off, Adam and Eve are working in this beautiful, pristine garden, and they're finding fulfillment and just this joyful relationship they have with God, doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing. And that's kind of how God designed the human workplace to be, a exhilarating pleasure of accomplishments, not a frustrating pain. And the question is, what happened? Well, Genesis 3 tells us, and you could read the chapter, Genesis 3, if you want, but to summarize it, lured by Satan's lies, the first people did something unthinkable. They rebel against God. Like, they're here and they're going, well, let's not do what God says. And they get punished, so sin and death enter God's good world. And Adam and Eve get expelled from the Garden of Eden. Paradise is lost. It is devastating. And sin, the own choices that people make, wreaks a devastating effect in ways that impact you every single day. We need to see what happens here. This is Genesis 3. Let me set these verses up. So after Adam and Eve, they rebel against God. God calls them out. And it's a weird scene. They're hiding in the garden from God, which that's a little silly. But here's what God says to Adam and Eve. And you can just listen how this affects your everyday work. This is verse 17. And to Adam, God said, because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree about which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. In other words, because you decide to sin, cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it will bring forth to you, and you shall eat the plants of the field by the sweat of your face. You shall eat bread until you return to the ground, for out of it you are taken. For you are dust, and to dust you shall return. This is huge. Like, do you know what's wrong with your work? I mean, the short answer is, you see the word God uses there? Like, it's cursed. And you don't even realize it because you're just so used to how messed up things are. But like that voice in the back of your head is right. There is something really wrong about how things work. And most of you recognize how our workplaces look well after Genesis 3. Work isn't paradise. Work is work. It's toilsome. It's hard. Thorns and thistles bring the frustrating sweat of exertion to the human brow. You could tell better stories than I could. There are lots of ways this look. But you know, we've got an apple tree right next to the parsonage, and it's kind of amazing. Birds love sitting in the branches right next to the house, and birds that love fruit, apparently, become gardeners. And I love watching this. I'm not positive about this. I'm going with what Ewald told me years ago, but apparently birds come with their little green talons, I guess, and they go over there and they plant seeds like gardeners, carefully wrapped in fertilizer, and it's just amazing. Like I feel like Snow White, just like whistling, and the birds are gardening. I'm sorry, I got little daughters, and we just talk about Snow White now. It could be beautiful, but really, in real life, all it means is that no matter how often I weed the bed underneath the apple tree, I can win the ground war, I guess. I can get the weeds out for about 5 minutes, but these birds are still planting seeds. And it would be great if they're planting like flowers or something. But do you know what the birds plant? Poison ivy and thistles. And all that stuff grows like what? Isn't that a funny expression? Like, it just tells us how messed up things are. Like, what grows fast? The weeds, right? That's how messed up the world is. So last week, I find my son Jude. He's in kindergarten, and he's right next to the apple tree, and he is mad because he went out there in his bare feet, and he went in the bed, and he stepped on a thistle in his bare feet, and he's upset. Like, he's not just hurt. Like, he's got a little bit of pain going on, but he's mostly just angry. And I'm just watching what he's thinking, and he's thinking to himself, how could a plant stab me like that? And he's thinking, like, what did I ever do to the plant? It's like the plant just comes at me. And he's, like, mad, like his sister just hit him. And he's sort of expecting me to go to the thorn bush, like, thistle, say I'm sorry. like that's going to happen. Like, well, I'm so sorry. But instead, I mean, this is what happened. I guess I blame the victim. It's kind of his fault. And there I am explaining to my kindergartner, Jude, why you should stay out of this bed and why you should wear shoes. And what I hear myself saying is, Jude, stay out of there. Thistles aren't even the worst problem. There's poison ivy, I said. So Jude's like, what is poison ivy? Like, he thinks it's a superhero from Batman or something. And I'm like, no, and he thinks, is this a plant I'm not supposed to eat? And he's right. And he has lots of questions. And I'm sitting there explaining it to him. And there's something, for me at least, about explaining things like this to through the eyes of a kid. Because we're so used to, you all know what poison ivy is, but there is something surprising about seeing it through new eyes. And you know, I explained to him, I don't need to explain to you because you know how it works, but I'm like, no, it's not just you can't eat it. Like, Jude, there are such a thing as plants that look healthy and shiny, and if you touch it, like, it's not even going to hurt you. Like, it's going to feel fine. And his eyes just start getting bigger because it sounds crazy when you explain this to a kindergartner. So I'm like, there is a plant that grows everywhere like a weed, and if you touch it, it like sneaks up on you later. Like, it poisons you, and later on, like tonight or the next day, you're going to get a bad rash. And then he's like, because he's a kindergartner, like, what's a rash? And then I have to explain to him what a rash is. Like, you know, and I'm hoping, all I really care about is that him not going in this bed. But he's in kindergarten, and it's a long day, and I'm watching the poor kid, like, Jude's just, like, sitting there with tears running down his face. Like, and there's a part of his innocence that just got lost. Like, for his whole life, he's assuming that the world's out to help him, and that plants are giving him berries and food and apples. Then in that moment, there he is, like, the world is out to get me. Like, there's this camouflage poison stuff that's going to put me in a lot of pain. And I'm one of those, like, dads that, like, I don't want to be the guy that discourages questions. So when one of my kids ask why, like, maybe I should just say, stop asking why, but instead I try answering it. And that's a really tough game sometimes. And what I've noticed is that when we play the why game, we usually end up in Genesis chapter 3 in, like, between 3 and 7 whys. Like, so here I am. It happens a lot. Jude, stay out of bed. And he's like, why? Because the birds planted poison ivy. And he's like, why would the birds do that? Like, what do I do to the birds? Like, I don't know. Back to Genesis 3, I guess. Or Jude, stay away from poison ivy. Why? Because poison ivy gives you a bad rash. What's a rash? Well, it just really, really hurts. Like, just trust me on this one. Why? And there I am, back in Genesis chapter 3. Like, seriously, whenever my kids ask questions within, like, 7 whys, it usually goes back to Genesis 3. Why do I have to buckle my seatbelt? Why are there accidents? Why do vegetables taste so bad? Why is homework so annoying? Why do I have to clean my room? Why are things messed up? Usually, like, I got a couple of other things to say, but eventually I get back to this chapter of the Bible. And when you read the story in Genesis 3, You could almost feel the intensity of the hurricane-like winds that rearrange the entire landscape of human existence. And you could start feeling the groaning of creation and the weariness that is just part of our work that we just are so used to that we take for granted. That work becomes a heavy yoke. And sometimes it's more than we can bear. There's this biblical imagery of a curse starts to paint a dire picture of the far-reaching and devastating consequences of what happens when people rebel against a good, just, and holy God. Like, you know what this is like now. Your world, your work is frustrating and at times messed up. And here's why. Genesis 3 tells us in riveting language that we are a broken people who live and work in a broken world, and there's something really wrong. It's not the way it's supposed to be. And the Apostle Paul makes the point that we live in this world where, along of the curse and fallen creation, we all feel the pain of not just being separated from God, that's a big theme of the Bible, but just living in sort of the messed up world. And I think with a sense of hope, the Apostle Paul looks toward the gospel and the glorious future of redemption. And like obviously, we're going to have to talk about some hope and some good news at some point, but it's worth starting with the reality of how messed up things can be. The Apostle Paul describes in inherent groaning. He writes, this is Romans chapter 8, 22. "For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. And not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, we groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for the adoption of sons as sons, the redemption of our bodies." Like, this is big. Like, the Apostle Paul touches a lot of like themes in the Bible in this verse, but what I love is the metaphor here of childbirth. This is what it's like being in our world right now. Working at having a baby is a joyful thing, but it's also a painful thing. That's what your work is like. At this point, because of the curse, because of the fall of man, your work, your workplaces can be frustrating, can be difficult, they can be painful. And it hasn't always been like that, and it won't be like that forever. But right now, you are going to be better off if you are aware of what's happened. That your work is deeply affected by the devastating consequences of sin, and sin entering into the world and messing up like God's original plans. It's changed everything about everything you do. It's made the very nature of what you're trying to do harder than it should be. And you know this. Your work at times is often painfully difficult. The systems, the technologies, the structure that you face every day might feel like it's working against you because it's a product of a fallen, broken world. You're going to have to deal with difficult people. Sorry. You're going to have wrong sorts of competition. You'll run into government regulation, threats of litigation. There's a long list we can make that complicate your workplace. You'll probably encounter dishonesty and backstabbing, and some jobs are just horrible. And not only is your work difficult, but sometimes we don't know what to do with it. Sometimes it feels empty and meaningless. Like, sometimes I'll bet you work, you put a full day in, and you end up scratching your head going, "What did I do today?" Because it feels like you're running the, what do they call it? The rat race, right? Like, that's how people think about work. Tom Nelson, who I've learned a lot from, he toured the country talking about the topic of work. And what he said is that when he talks to people about work, the main question people ask right away is, "Tom, you're the expert. Can you tell me that what I do matters for something?" That's a big deal. Sometimes it feels like your work doesn't matter at all. And this is something the Bible has a really realistic view about, too. The book of Ecclesiastes talks about the disillusionment with work. And this is what it's like in the fallen world, that sometimes your work feels futile. The phrase Ecclesiastes uses is, I read a couple of verses from chapter 2. So he writes, "So I hated life," which sounds bad, "because what is done under the sun was grievous to me. For all is vanity and a striving after the wind. I hated my toil." I hated my work, he says, "which I worked for under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who comes after me." Then he asks, "What has a man for all the toil and striving of heart which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even at night his heart does not rest. This also," he says, "is vanity." In other words, I work really hard. I don't know what the point is. To be fair, in Ecclesiastes, the next chapter, he says things like, I think there's nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. And everyone should eat and take drink and take pleasure in all their work, for this is God's gift to man. So he has mixed feelings, I guess, about work. And you've had mixed feelings too, I'll bet. There's a realistic view of work in the fallen world. Work is a gift. It's a curse. It's frustrating. It's exhilarating. Here's what I know. Your work, whatever it looks like, can both give evidence of our glorious calling and our creation, and also evidence of how messed up life is. And it should remind us that we need someone to fix it, redeem us from the curse of sin. Like, this is the problem with work, right? Sometimes it seems fulfilling, sometimes it seems frustrating, sometimes it doesn't seem worth it. And on top of that, like, some of our problem isn't just work that is hard, or like we get disillusioned, but not only that, sometimes not only is work messed up, but work can mess you up when you ascribe the wrong worth to it, when you get off balance about it. Like, you know what you call when you take a good thing like work and make it into your functional god? Like, one of the ways that we make work an idol or value work more than God is labeled workaholism, right? Which is a problem, right? Valuing work too much can mess people up. It can mess your health up. It can mess up your relationships up. When you put your work above people, it's bad for your life. And the Bible says a ton about this. We might have to talk about this later, the problem of when work becomes your functional god. Or on the other hand, instead of making work your idol, like, we're good at messing things up, we make the mistake of undervaluing work. So there are people, instead of being workaholics, they live for leisure, and it looks like being lazy or slothful. There are folks who don't work as much as they should, which, guess what? It's a problem. It's bad for your health. It's bad for relationships. It's bad for life. And the Bible warns an awful lot about that too. When not working, when leisure is your god, that and more are things that you encounter on Monday. Like, you got to deal with this. Not only is there a high risk for things going wrong this week, for, you know, there's a good chance you're going to get frustrated. Murphy's Law is going to be true. But not only that, but we're not even good at processing things. Our priorities get off balance. Our identity gets off. It's all at risk. And let's just start off by admitting this is a problem. Now, Jim Collins tells a story about his interview with Admiral Jim Stockdale. And one of the things about him is he, as a young man, spent years as a POW in Vietnam. And it was really hard. So Jim Collins asked him a really hard question. He asked the Admiral, "Admiral, can you tell me the difference in your experience between the many prisoners of wars you were with who lost hope and gave up because things were hard? And what separated them from people who endured such a tortured existence as a POW?" The Admiral replied, he said, the thing that made the difference for POWs, people who were living in a really hard place, between people who died and people who survived, the Admiral said, The difference was having hopeful realism. What it says is people that were idealistic, who said, you know, we're going to be home by Christmas, it's going to be great, it's not that bad, those are the ones that just crashed and burned. Because they weren't ready for Christmas after Christmas coming and going. And then he said prisoners who had a realistic view of what they're up against, who said this might be awful, but we're going to get through it, who prepared themselves for a long and difficult captivity, but still had hope to believe that they would eventually make it back home. He said those are the ones who survived. And I want us to be the ones that survive in the face of adversity. Again, Tom Nelson, who researched this a ton, is convinced that what people like us need to do is to cultivate what he calls an optimistic realism, if we're going to thrive in our work. And I think, here's what it looks like. I think a lot of people, we get phantom dreams of a dream job, right? And we get this idea, like, this is what work should be like. And let's be real, like, it's going to be hard. Like, you may get disillusioned about your work. You may feel a growing lack of contentment. You might find yourself going from job to job to job because you're looking for, like, the greener grass on the other side of the job fence. But how are you approaching your work? Are you idealistic or realistic? Like, the perfect job, the perfect career, it's not unrealistic. Or it's not just unrealistic, it's like there are Bible problems with it, right? Like, even if you have your dream job, I will guarantee you it's going to be hard. You may finally arrive to where you want to be, and you're still going to find frustrations, and it's still not going to be everything you dreamed that it would be. Whatever work you're called to, I will guarantee it'll be a mixture of both the good and the not good. And you and I, we will all be better off if we recognize that at this point in the story of the Bible, your work will not be all you want it to be. Look, the Mondays are tough. Things will probably go wrong. And I can see the joy. You all look very cheery about that. Like, what a great uplifting message you've got today. This is great. And you're not wrong. A problem this big, though, which is all we've talked about so far, it needs a God-sized solution to speak into it. And that's what we're going to talk about next week, coming to grips with getting out of this big problem. There is one who is big enough to give hope and purpose in our work. Next week, we're going to talk about how Jesus changes our broken workplace. And I hope you can make it till then through your work week, whatever it looks like, because we have a lot to talk about. For now, let's just pray. Father in heaven, can you help us as we come to grips with life in a fallen world? Can you help us to be realistic? Can you help us not to hope in things that cannot satisfy, not to be overwhelmed? Help us not to over or under prioritize the calling that you've placed on us. And can we start to see how being close to you, O God, starts to make the fallen world better, and how you save us from the mess, sometimes self-imposed, that we find ourselves in. Father, most of all, I pray that you would draw us closer to you in a way that gives us perspective, energy, and hope for whatever task you've called us to. I ask this in the name of Jesus. Amen.